Wolfgang Wieland, and he's going to talk about tell us about Hamiltonian spin form gravity. Please start.
So thank you, and welcome to my seminar, and I thank all of you for joining this. So my talk is about my last paper that is now in the archive, and the title is Hamiltonian spin foam gravity. So let's go to slide 0.1, where I will speak about, where I will give you a short motivation of what I'm doing. So as we all know, loop quantum gravity falls in two parts. First of all, there is the canonical approach, starting from the ADM formalism, while on the other hand, there is the spin foam approach, which seeks to directly define transition amplitudes for loop quantum gravity. Both approaches share their kinematical structure, that is, the Hilbert space with operators representing area, angles, and parallel transport. Now, the crucial question is whether this kinematical relation also extends beyond kinematics and can reveal a solid framework also for the dynamics of the theory. Indications supporting a relation so far only come from symmetry-reduced models, that is, loop quantum cosmology. So within the reduced setting of a fixed discretization of space-time, I will try to answer this question in the affirmative. So to say that there is canonical quantization procedure which leads to the spin foam approach. So we now go to 0.2, where I will give you an outline of what I'm doing. So section 1 recalls the seminar of a few months ago, where Simone Speziale talked about spinors as covariant variables for loop quantum gravity. Section 2 introduces a kind of introduces a continuum formulation and the Hamiltonian analysis for spin foam gravity. This is on the classical side. If there is still time, I will go to section 3, where we'll talk about the quantization problem. Within all this seminar, I will heavily use the spinorial framework of our theory. And that is useful because it deals with the nonlinearities appearing in the loop gravity phase space by embedding the loop gravity phase space in a larger structure with canonical Dabur coordinates. So now we are ready for the first chapter, which is a review of what has already appeared. So we are now on slide 1.1. And I briefly review BF theory in terms of self-dual variables. So equation 1 is just the BF action written in terms of SL2C valued fields. So F indices AB is the curvature of the self-dual connection. It's an SL2C valued 2 form. So indices AB, capital AB running from 0 to 1 are spinorial indices that transform under the fundamental representation of SF2C, which is the universal cover of the Lorentz group. Now, sigma subindices AB, on the other hand, is the conjugate variable. It is the infinitesimal area element. In BF theory, it is not subject to any constraints, which means the theory to be topological. If you want to describe gravity by this action, we need additional constraints, which impose that sigma subindices AB describes the self-dual part of the Blavatsky 2 form. In front of this combination, sigma contracted with curvature, with the curvature tensor, there is a complex number, which is beta plus I over beta. And that is, of course, so beta is, of course, nothing than the Valero inertia parameter, and I is the imaginary unit. And for this action to be real, we also need the complex conjugate. And therefore, there's also the complex conjugate representation appearing with indices transforming in the anti-Salesforce representation. And so we are interested in canonical quantization. So we need to identify the momentum conjugate. And this is nothing but sigma AB multiplied by this complex number beta plus I over 2i beta. So now we go to the next slide, slide 1.2. So in loop quantum gravity, we are dealing with smeared variables because they are considerably simpler for the quantization problem. So what I take here is I start with the discretization, a simplicial decomposition of space-time. On a given spatial slice, this introduces a triangulation. And the elementary building blocks are tetrahedra, consisting of four triangles glued among the bounding surfaces. And now we can smear, of course, all our elementary phase space variables over the natural structures appearing. So the SL2C connection, in fact, that is just the original Ashtekar connection, we just smear over the links dual to the surfaces, obtaining the parallel transport or the holonomy. For the dual variables, on the other hand, we smear them over the surfaces dual to the links, that is the triangle. Since we want to arrive at a quantity transforming nicely on the local Lorentz transformation, the smearing has to be done in a certain frame. And therefore, in equation 4b, there are these additional holonomies, h sub p, sub index p, where p denotes a point on the triangle that maps the triangle into the frame of the tetrahedron around the initial point of the link. Now, the continuous Poisson brackets induce commutation relations among holonomies and fluxes. The flux acts on the Hamiltonian vector field of the flux, acts as a left invariant vector field, while the Poisson bracket of two fluxes recovers the Lie algebra of the Lorentz group. And as for the continuous theory, the sectors of opposite chirality commute. So now we go to the next slide, slide 1.3. And now we introduce spinors to find a convenient parametrization of the phase space of holonomies and fluxes. If you look at the elementary building block of our phase space on a graph, then this is just T star of SL2C for each link. That is for each line connecting to the tetrahedron. If you now look at the flux in the frame of the initial point, then we can always find a pair of spinors that diagonalize the flux. This is written in equation 6. So pi sub, sub indices, capital pi sub indices AB is just a symmetrized tensor product of a pair of spinors. Now these spinors belong to the frame of the initial point of the link. And we can now take the holonomy and map them to the final point of the link, obtaining another pair of spinors. And we denote them in equation 7, pi tilde and omega tilde. But now, if the initial pair was linearly independent, that is, the contraction of pi with omega is non-vanishing, the pair pi A and omega A, so the pair of spinors, form a basis. And if we have a basis, we can kind of reverse the logic. So we start with a quadruple of spinors attached to the initial and final point respectively. And then we can use equations 6 and 8 to write both holonomy and flux in terms of spinors. So now we go to slide 1.4. Now this parameterization is certainly not unique. There are in fact two symmetries. The first of which, equation 9a, replaces simultaneously pi and omega and pi tilde omega tilde. The other one is a continuous symmetry, a scaling symmetry that just rescales the spinors at both the initial and final point. To recover holonomies and fluxes, we need two constraints. The first one is that pi and omega are linearly independent. So that is equation 10a. The second constraint tells us that the Lorentz invariant inner product that we can construct from the spinors, so the construction pi a omega a, must agree when going along the link. So the inner product on the initial point of the spinors on the initial point must be the same as the spinors on the final point. Now both of these equations have a physical interpretation. The first one tells us that the surfaces we are dealing with cannot have degenerate flux, that is, that they are not null triangles. But since we are dealing with spatial hypersurfaces anyhow, this is no trouble. Equation 10b, on the other hand, just tells us that the area of the triangle is the same as seen from the two sides, so seen in the two frames. So far, we have just parametrized holonomies and fluxes by spinors. What we now have to ask is whether we can also recover the symplectic structure. And for this, we just declare the pi spinor to be the momentum conjugate of the omega spinor at both the initial and final point. So these are equations 11a and 11b. And now we go to slide 1.5, and I tell you how to recover the original pi space. So on the constrained hypersurface of the area matching constraints, we recover the commutation relations of holonomies and fluxes. The constraint itself generates gauge transformations that precisely corresponds to the scaling transformations I told you earlier. And if we now perform a symplectic quotient, that is, just look at the orbits generated by the constraint, we obtain the original phase space. So now we go further to slide 1.6. So what I've told you so far was just about the topological theory. But to recover general relativity, we need additional constraints that guarantee that the bivectors are geometrical. That is, that they correspond to planes in a local Minkowski space orthogonal to a common normal. So a normal one for each tetrahedron. And these are the linear simplicity constraints. Now for each triangle, these are three constraints. And if we now rewrite these constraints in terms of our spinorial variables, we get three other constraints which are functionally the same. And these are equations 12a and 12b. So the first one is, as we can see, because of the appearance of the complex conjugate, is just a real number. While the second one is complex. So the first one is just a combination of the Lorentz invariant construction of pi and omega. And the second one, and only in the second one, there appears the normal of the tetrahedron. So n with indices a and a bar is a 2 by 2 matrix. And this 2 by 2 matrix is of course nothing but the normal of the tetrahedron. simply because every vector in Minkowski space corresponds in spin notation to a Hermitian 2 by 2 matrix, and this 2 by 2 matrix is NA A bar. And concerning, because we want at some point to quantize these constraints, we have to study the algebra. And what we find is that the constraint D equals 0 is first class, while the constraint F equals 0 is second class. And again, both constraints have a physical interpretation. D equals 0 tells us that the area of the triangle is real, and F sub n equals 0 tells us that the vector, that the normal is orthogonal to the triangle. So now we go to an intermediate summary. So that is slide 1.7. And if you wish, you can ask questions now. Hello?
So to write down the second constraint, which is really the thing with the normal, if you can just go back one slide, which is 1.5
yes.
Maybe.
Yes.
Sorry.
1.5.
Yeah, 1.6. I'm sorry. 1.6.
Yes.
So to write down the second constraint, you have to now invoke this normal, right? Which didn't feature
yes.
So far. So it's an external element.
Exactly. Right. Yes.
Okay.
So it's an additional. Element of the theory.
Right. So it's an additional element associated with each kind of the common triangle to the tetrahedra. Associated with each common triangle between two tetrahedra, you're going to have an extra element.
So it is a normal for each. So it's an element for each tetrahedron. So there is one normal for each tetrahedron.
I'm sorry, you're right, yeah. One normal, this is normal to the, yeah, to the tree surface, right. So each normal is normal to the tree surface. Okay, so this is just an external C number that is just given to you once and for all.
Yes.
Not a dynamical variable.
It's not a dynamical variable. Right.
Okay, thank you.
So we go to the summary, 1.7. So, we have seen the phase space on a spatial slice is T star of SL to C to the power of L, where L is the number of links. Then we went to a spinorial representation, where this phase space is parameterized by 4 spinors per link. And that was useful because the symplectic structure simplifies. So the spinors are canonical coordinates on phase space. And what I have not mentioned, but what has appeared in Speciale's talk was that on the solution space of these constraints that were on the last slide, one can introduce SU2 spinors. So by SU2 spinors, I mean that they transform linearly only under rotations, but they are not transforming linearly under boosts. And this reduction then leads us to the original SU2 spinor framework of loop quantum gravity, which is the SU2, which is a parametrization of the phase space of SU2 Ashtekar-Barbero variable. So this gives the relation between the covariant theory and the SU2 theory. So, but that was in another talk. Okay, so now we go to the next section, which is section 2. Where speak about the continuum formulation. So we are on slide 2.1. So the last section was just about kinematics. And here I would like to talk about the dynamics of the theory on a fixed simplicial discretization. So the discretization consists of 4 simplices glued among bounding tetrahedra, and each 4 simplex consists of 5 tetrahedra glued among the bounding triangles. It is also important to think in the dual picture, which I have drawn on the right. So each triangle is dual to a spinform phase. And the spinform phase is shared by many force implices, which are the dual of a vertex. The part of a spinform phase that belongs to a given force simplex, we call a wedge. And the boundary of a wedge consists of two parts. So there is one part which is in the boundary of the force simplex, so which is in the spatial boundary, so to speak, and this is a link. So a link connects two tetrahedra along the boundary of the force simplex. And the other part enters the force simplex and goes into the bulk, so to speak. So this part goes from one from the center of one tetrahedron towards the vertex into another tetrahedron. And now we discretize the action on these lower dimensional surfaces, and that is in equation 13. So we smear the curvature tensor over the wedges and the momentum variable over the triangles dual to the wedge. And now we go to section slide 2.2. Now,
before you go before you do that, could we just repeat again what the wedge was? I got confused between the wedge and edge. So could you say what the wedge W is?
So the wedge W is the part of the spinform phase that lies inside a force simplex. So the spinform phase is dual to a triangle. And if you now look at the part of the spinform phase which lies inside the force, a given force simplex, then you call this a wedge. So there is one wedge per each vertex which is adjacent to the spinform phase.
Okay, thank you.
And now we discretize everything on the wedges. So to do so, we use our the spinorial description. So for the flux, which is in equation 14b, the situation is simple. We just use the formulas on the last slide. But for the curvature, it is a bit more tricky. So first of all, we remember that the curvature, that the holonomy around the loop approximates the curvature tensor smeared along the surface which is encircled by the loop. So that is equation 14a. But now we want to write this holonomy in terms of spinors. But we can only use spinors for half of the loop. That is because spinors parametrize the holonomy in the boundary of the force simplex. While we need additional holonomies, I call them bulk holonomies G and G tilde, to close the loop. That is, to go from the boundary inside the force simplex. So to say once again, the loop around the wedge consists of two parts. And only one part, namely the part on the right side, which is the link, can be parametrized by spinors, while for the other part, I just use additional fields G and G tilde, which are SL2C holonomies. And if I now insert 14A and 14B together with the spinorial parametrization of the holonomy in the action for a wedge, I get to equation 15. So that is a discretization of the BF action on a wedge. But it is not so nice to work with completely discretized variables, and therefore what we do now in slide 2.3 is a partial continuum limit back into a continuum theory. And what we, and how, yes?
Yeah, is this, yes, is this action subject still to your three new constraints, G and F?
No, because what I've considering here so far is just BF theory. What I will do later is to add the constraints which you were mentioning to this action to define an action for BF theory plus simplicity constraints. So equation 17, that is the final result, is just the BF action, the contribution to the BF action from a wedge. And what we see here, yes?
For the complexified theory, D is the reality conditions, roughly.
No, sorry, that is, so this is what I wanted to say now. So in equation 17, there is D or DT. So what is this D or DT? That is just the covariant derivative with respect to the connection, with respect to the SL2C connection along the edge. So D sub D or DT pi omega is a covariant derivative. So it is just below equation 17, the definition.
Okay, thank you.
I am confused about what are the dynamical variables now. What does the action depend on? There is omega pi, but there is also this big D, right? That is some connection thing. So I'm not clear as to what our dynamical variables are on which the action depends.
So the action depends on, so for a single wedge, W, the action depends on a pair of spinors and this field AB contracted with the tangent vector of the edge. And this is, and we will see in I think two slides, that the role of this the connection contracted with the tangent vector of the edge is a Lagrange multiplier that enforces the Gauss law. So the action depends on spinors and this additional connection.
Okay, thank you.
So as a first test, let us go to slide 2.4 and study the equations of motion which come from this action. So what we now have to check is whether this formulation is consistent with BF theory. So equation 17 on the last slide, I said, is just the contribution to the BF action coming from a single wedge. And what we have now to ask is whether the equations of motion are consistent. So if we look at the equations for pi and omega, what we get is that they are just covariantly constant along the edge. So d over dt, again, to remind you, is the covariant derivative in the direction of the edge. And we will later see that this constraint reflects the vanishing of curvature in the plane of the in the plane of the wedge. Furthermore, we have seen spinors correspond to holonomies and fluxes only if certain constraints are satisfied. And we have to ask whether these constraints are now also satisfied in this continuous formulation. So what was this constraint? It was the area matching constraint. In this kind of continuum limit, the area matching constraint just becomes a conservation law along the evolution along the edge, and it just tells us that the contraction, so this is equation 19, pi a omega is constant in time, and we can easily check that equation 18 does of course fulfill this condition. Next, we go to slide 2.5, and here we go back to the question of Abai, where he asked, so what does the action actually depends on, and what is the role of this additional Lagrange multiplier. And this this concerns the Gauss law. So the action I was introducing to you belongs to one wedge, but on a single edge, four wedges are meeting. So why is that? So we are considering tetrahedra. So each tetrahedron consists of four triangles. For each triangle, there is now on each triangle we now introduce spinors to parametrize our phase space. But the edges, the wedges meet along the edges, and therefore this Lagrange multiplier, so which I call phi ad of t, which is just below equation 21, appears in the actions of all of them. So if we perform the variation of the action with respect to this multiplier, we recover the Gauss law. So if we look at the complete action, that is not just the action for a single wedge, but just sum all contributions, the action depends on spinors, one pair for each triangle, and this additional Lagrange multiplier. And the variation of the action with respect to the Lagrange multiplier gives us back the Gauss law. Okay. So now we go to slide 2.6. And here I'm answering another question that appeared. So whether one should add the additional constraint. And this is what is done in equation 23. So I just introduced additional Lagrange multipliers and used them to add the constraints to the action, which are just the linear simplicity constraints written in terms of spinors. Now, in this action, there appears the normal of the tetrahedron as a function of t. But in the discrete theory, we only have it at some points. So I have to give you a description how to make the normal continuum field along the edge. And this is in equation 24. So I just simply assume that the normal is covariantly constant along the edge, which is, I think, a rather natural assumption. If we remember that in the spin form approach, we are always dealing with locally flat geometry. So now we can go to slide 2.7 and study the equations of motion for the spinors. So again, I just look at the equation of motion for the spinors on one spin form phase, so I don't have to add labels referring to the various triangles. And this is equation 25a. So in these evolution equations that come from the action, there appears a Hamiltonian, which is just a linear combination of the simplicity constraint. And what we have now to check is whether the evolution defined by this Hamiltonian preserves the constraint, and if not, whether we have to add additional secondary constraints. And what we find is that for the second class constraint, Fn equals 0, so the one where there appears the time normal, that this constraint is generically not constraint unless we fix the Lagrange multiplier in front of this constraint to 0. So we can make this constraint to be conserved four times without adding any secondary constraints. Then we have to look at the remaining constraints, and what we find is that all of them are preserved in time, so along this parameter, without the need of any secondary constraint. And for the area matching constraint, again, it is constrained. It is preserved in time. So in other words, the system is consistent. So there are no additional secondary constraints, and all constraints are preserved in time, provided the Lagrange multiplier in front of the second class constraint vanishes. And if we now insert this condition on the multiplier into equation 26, we get the secondary Hamiltonian, which is just proportional to this D constraint. Now,
excuse me, question. So, since we imposed the simplicity constraint, we should be back with to the GR. Is that correct?
Well, that is hopefully yes.
Yes. So would one expect to see a Hamiltonian constraint here? And when, if yes, where is it?
Well, the answer. So that is a very difficult question, in fact. But I would say the reason why I cannot see a Hamiltonian constraint is because I'm not doing an ADM 3 plus 1 split of an action, but I'm using another Hamiltonian formulation of the equations of motion, which do not use an ADM split, but use some formalism which is better adapted to the discretization that we are always using. So it is a kind of local Hamiltonian formalism, and there is no Hamiltonian constraint in the sense of ADM, but there is a Hamiltonian that generates the equations of motion, and this is equation 26, and kind of similar to the ADM formalism, this Hamiltonian is also constrained to vanish, so it's just a sum of constraints.
Yeah, but one can ask the question that Norbert was asking slightly differently, namely, okay, so you have a Hamiltonian theory, but what does it have to do with general relativity?
Well, I would say the equations, these are just the equations of motion for BF theory plus linear simplicity constraints. And in spin from gravity, we believe that this is general relativity. And what I've introduced here is a Hamiltonian formalism of these equations of motion with the Poisson bracket and the Hamiltonian and all this. But without referring to ADM. But
question, aren't there, excuse me for being naive here, but aren't there other simplicity constraints that also require to get the full reduction to general relativity?
So there is the, this is true, so there is the volume simplicity constraint, as it is sometimes called. But if the if the Poe simplex is flat and both the Gauss law and the linear simplicity constraints hold, this condition is automatically satisfied. So the hope is that this quadratic simplicity constraint is not needed because we are dealing. We're working with a locally flat geometry.
That's a hope at this point. That's not demonstrated, even classically. It's fine what you're doing. I just want to understand the status of the claim.
The last one I haven't heard, sorry.
No, it's just... So this is general relativity modulo this hope, but you don't have, but it's not, it could be, you could be missing general relativity if the hope is wrong.
Yes, that's, yes.
Okay, thanks.
So, but let's go back to that, because I think this question is critical here. Because at some stage you did say that a paratransport that you're using for the covariant normal to the tetrahedra, that was in some sense implementing the piecewise flatness condition. But I mean, is the point that it is not really doing that, it is kind of motivated by that? Or is it the statement that somehow you can see that that parallel transport condition is in fact implementing the piecewise flat net, and therefore this additional volume simplicity constraint is not needed? I mean, is that, what is the mathematical status there?
So I would say that locally flatness implies that this normal is covariantly constant, but it's not in the other way around. That, so it could be that this is not sufficient, so to say.
Right.
So
that was Lee's criticism a little bit more, right? I mean, maybe not Lee's point a little bit more, that there's a gap, and the gap is precisely that the converse is not true, that it may be that the time-like normal is actually parallel, is covariantly constant, but you may have to add some other things in order to make sure that the volume simplicity constraint is actually satisfied. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, okay. I agree very much with this, absolutely. So it could, what I'm doing here is just I take the assumptions that were kind of always hidden in the construction of our models seriously and see how far I can get with this. So it could very much be that this is too weak. Of course.
Yeah. Good. Thank you.
So
there's another question, sorry.
So Wolfgang, if I may just ask another question. So is your statement that, so at first you're using the linear simplicity constraint, so this would be for you the analog of the usual primary informed simplicity constraint, and then this condition of conserved parallel transport of the normal, this would be the analog of the secondary simplicity constraint? Or the reality conditions, or?
No, I don't think that this has I mean, the secondary constraints are, so in the secondary constraints, so in the ADM, if we do first order ADM formalism, we find that the secondary constraints are the torsionless conditions. And I don't see how this covariantly, of the normal being covariantly constant along the edge is related to the vanishing of torsion. So I don't think that this assumption of the normal being covariantly constant has to do with the, but I'm not sure about this.
Thank you. Okay. Because in fact, I was asking this because I think that in the continuum, if you take the Hamiltonian-Lebesgue theory and replace the quadratic simplicity constraints by the linear one, in fact, it's not possible to replace the secondary simplicity constraint by a constraint that does not depend on the B field, such as, for example, covariantly conserved normal, which does not depend on the B field but only on the connection. So this is not possible in the continuous theory.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to point this out.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. So now we go to slide 2.8. And here I want to show you that the equations of motion have a clean geometrical interpretation. So, and this goes as follows. So if we remember, so equation 28 gives the variation of the holonomy under variation of the loop of the underlying path. So if you vary the holonomy with respect to path, with respect to the path, we get equation 28. So the first two terms are just boundary terms, where the connection is contracted with the variation of the loop at the initial and final point. And the last part, the kind of most important one, gives the curvature tensor smeared along the infinitesimal surface spanned by the variation of the curve. And we can use this equation very nicely to find the geometric meaning of the equations of motion. So if we along the edge there's a continuous time variable now, and consider now two spinors at two points which are infinitesimally close to another, so pi of t and pi of t plus epsilon. But pi of t plus epsilon has a geometric meaning. It is, in fact, that is just how we constructed the spinors. It is the parallel transport of the spinor pi along the triangularly shaped region path. So along the path that goes first along gamma t and then along gamma t plus epsilon in the picture. And if we now compute the time derivative of the spinor, then if you think of the spinor moving along this edge, then you can realize that this is just a variation of the path. So we can just use equation 28 to write the covariant derivative of the spinors in equation 29 as a contraction with the curvature tensor smeared along this infinitesimal triangle. And equation 29, A and B, they just hold by construction of the spinors. They have nothing to do with the equations of motion. But if we go to the next slide, slide 2.9, we can now remember the equations of motion and read off the curvature tensor smeared along the wedge. And what we get is what I write in equation 31. So the curvature tensor smeared along the wedge is just proportional to the two form sigma. In fact, if we integrate the curvature tensor all along the spin form phase, we get equation 32. So the curvature tensor smeared along the spin form phase is proportional to the flux through the dual triangle, which is exactly a relation, which is a relation very similar to Rayleigh calculus. So the curvature tensor is proportional to the flux along the smeared along the dual surface.
Question?
Yes.
Yeah. So isn't this equation 31 or 32? This says that the curvature tensor, the self-dual part of the curvature tensor, is proportional to the self-dual two-form, and this
yes.
is not relativity. This has solutions which are only self-dual spacetimes with cosmological constants. For example, De Sitter or anti-De Sitter spacetime.
No, I don't agree because. Because if you look at the sorry for the short interruption. If you look at equation 31 or 32, you find the curvature tensor is proportional to lambda times the self-dual two form, but this proportionality constant is not a constant, so it varies in space and time. So it's not a cosmological constant, but it's something that is locally, which is different at different points.
That there, that well, maybe you need to explain more, but it still is probably not as general as the pullback of the Einstein equation for the triangular space.
That's right. So it's not so a generic. So this equation 32 will certainly not give you the most general curvature tensor, but it is like in the Regge calculus, just a truncation. So also in Regge calculus, the curvature is locally of a certain Petrov type, but in if you take the mean along a certain space region, then the Petrov type is not something that sums up linearly. So you can have locally a certain form of your curvature tensor, which if you smear it over a bigger region, looks differently.
Okay.
It's just the truncation.
Okay.
I think this question is really that isn't the condition that even after this truncation, lambda is a constant rather than something which is spinner. In other words, supposing you had actually, instead of lambda, if you had lambda downstairs spinner indices ABCD contracted with sigma CD, then that would be completely general. But because so I think Lee is right that this is even after smearing and even after truncating, basically what we're saying is the following, right? That we've got a self-dual curvature, and then just from algebraic symmetries, it can be expanded out as a linear combination of self-dual two forms, which are sigma AB. But here you're saying that it's actually proportional to the self-dual two form, and not linear combinations of them. And so I think there is a restriction here.
But it's the same kind of restriction one does in Regge calculus, where also the curvature tensor is locally of a certain algebraic type. Okay, so I go to the summary of this section, and I think I'm already mostly out of time. So what we have seen is that I can write the gravitational action, or what we hope to be the gravitational action, as a one-dimensional line integral along the boundary of the spin form phases. And the equations of motion derived from this action admit a Hamiltonian formulation. And the Hamiltonian flow preserves all constraints of the theory without any secondary constraints. And in this third point was that the evolution equations have a geometrical interpretation and show that the model carries a non-vanishing curvature. So a curvature of certain algebraic type, and this we have also discussed. So I feel there is not so much time left for the third part, where I would have spoken about the quantum theory. So maybe I just catch this. So what one, maybe we go to slide number 3.2. So if we want to canonically quantize, what's happening is that one replaces the momenta by partial derivatives with respect to the configuration variable. So this is a Schrödinger quantization, and this is in equation 35. And now we want to impose the constraints. And this we do on in a certain basis that diagonalizes the constraints. And this basis is labeled by four quantum numbers, so O and K, which labels the irreducible unitary representations of the Lorentz group, and angular momentum, magnetic quantum numbers, J and M. And if we impose the constraints, we get restrictions of these labels, which I have on the next slide, slide 3.3. So we get just the usual restrictions on the irreducible labels appearing in the EPIL model. So the resulting states are just labeled by two quantum numbers, J and M, as in equation 14. And if we now go to slide 3.4, I can also sketch, or can also tell you about how to do dynamics with this framework. So we are on slide 3.4. So classically, the evolution of any observable, of any quantity O on K space is governed by the Hamilton equations. That is in equation 42. And if we quantize this, then the corresponding Schrödinger equation is in 43. And this is a rather simple equation because there is so in equation 43, you see the constraint D, but D is the physical states are annihilated by this constraint. So we just get on the physical for physical states, we just get the first term, which is just an infinitesimal Lorentz generator. And if we restrict the Lorentz transformation to be a boost, this is exactly the Hamiltonian Bianchi has recently used to study the entropy of black holes in spin form gravity. So let us go to the slide 3.6, to the summary of this section. So what I have sketched you is that one can quantize this theory, that if we take the simplicity constraints and map them into operators and find the corresponding solution space, this matches the Dupuy-Levine states of the EPIL model. And if we now quantize the Hamiltonian matches what Bianchi uses as Hamiltonian in the context of black hole dynamics, and so the dynamics on a spin form phase matches the EPIL model. What is not clear to me is how these individual amplitudes glue together to form a full spin form model, and this may very well be related to the question I was repeatedly asked on how the normal changes if we go into the along the edges. So the conclusion is basically let me go to the conclusion. So the last slide. So I have some definite answers, and these are the EPRL proposal for loop gravity transition amplitudes can be understood from a canonical quantization of a classical theory on a truncation of space-time. And I can also conclude the canonical analysis. And in this formulation, all constraints are preserved in time, so there are no secondary constraints. So that does, of course, not prove that the EPRL model is right, but it proves that it is internally consistent. And there are many open questions. And so one of them would be, so if there are no secondary constraints, it could be that we still miss additional constraints, and I would expect them to be related to how the amplitudes are glued together. So I'm finished now. Thank you.
Any further questions?
Yeah, I would like to go back, if possible, to equation 31, which is 2.9.
Yes.
I mean, I'm quite bothered about 31 and 32, just as Lee was. So as I was saying before, if in fact your equation was FAB is equal to, instead of lambda, if you had a psi and a spinner size, psi ABCD times sigma CD, then that would be perfect. And that's what one would mean by a vacuum equation.
Yes.
Because that I just see that the central curvature is given by the psi ABCD, which is the wide spinner, and it is saying that the rigid tensor is actually zero. But your equation is just opposite. Your equation says that FAB is kind of pure trace in the sense that it is just lambda times, if you like, delta, right? And this, instead of psi ABCD, you have got delta AC, delta C, delta BD. So I translate it into tensorial language. Your equation looks like saying that the full Riemann tensor has zero wild path and has pure scalar curvature. So it's, I agree that lambda is not a constant, and therefore your scalar curvature is not the cosmological constant. But in a sense, it is even worse, because then by Bianchi identity, there is a problem somewhere. Because, I mean, your equation of motion seems to be that the full Riemann tensor has only Ricci curvature, only scalar curvature. There's no wild tensor, and it has just a scalar curvature. And furthermore, the scalar curvature, which is captured by this lambda, varies from point to point.
So I have two answers to this question, which could save everything, let's say. So the first one is that equation 32 relates the curvature smeared along the face to the Lebesgue two form smeared along the dual, so the triangle. So it's not so FAB and sigma AB are smeared over two different geometrical quantities, while for the equation that you were referring, one would have to smear them over the same geometrical object, so over the same surface. And the second answer is...
So you're saying that equation 31 is wrong?
No. It's just that... in order to run the argument, I would have to have an equation FAB smeared over F is some spinorial tensor psi times sigma ab smeared over the same f, but here it is smeared over the door, so the triangle tau, which is not the same, which is the opposite. So it's not immediate
That will say that the equation doesn't hold, because left hand side has to be smeared or something, and right hand side has to be smeared or something. If the equation holds, I should be able to smear it on the same thing, right?
So they are in equation 32. Equation 32 is an equation for the discretized theory, so for a theory with a simplicial structure, and it relates two forms on different geometrical objects, not on the same.
Yeah. So therefore, from if in fact only 32 is correct, then 31 is not correct.
I see.
Okay. So, thank you. Okay, so that was our views of notation. So 32 is the, I should think of 32 as being the correct one. And then you are saying that it is being smeared on two different things.
But I'm clear.
I see. Okay, so it's not delta-delta, but it's really something else. Okay, so I think one would have to write down what the equation of motion is. But are you confused that the equation of motion is correct, that it is Einstein's, compatible with Einstein's theory, does the equation of motion really, does it really say that what you have is FAB is the self-dual path of the curvature coming from the tetra? Is that what the equation says, 32?
I'm not understanding at all how to construct the Ricci part, the Weyl part, and the scalar curvature out of equation 32. So this is absolutely what one has to check now, absolutely.
But then is your statement that this is a problem also for all spin form models? I mean, EPRL model, for example, is your statement that they also get the equation exactly around up to 32, and then its relation to Einstein's equation is not so clear? Is that what you're saying? Do other people agree with this?
Can I ask Dean a question? So usually the curvature in discrete gravity is distributional, and you derive really your equation of motion on a wedge. So would you say that these equations of motion hold everywhere, or that some distributional part should come from the vertices or whatever? Because in this case, the Riemann curvature usually in wedge gravity is just supported on some distributional part, which you might not see here. So this comes if you basically consider the vertex, the full vertex, these things together.
Yeah,
31 or 32 might be even true, and might be even constrained curvature. I mean, actually, mostly if you consider this construction, you would probably get that it has to be zero, or it has to be constantly curved, or something like that. And the Ricci, for instance, the Riemann tensor, or the Ricci tensor, has only support on 4D on the faces, on the triangles, which are here the edges. So here's also two things.
Right. So it would be on the faces, on the F, right? I said the curvature, both Ricci and Y, will be supported on the face F.
So what my comment is, maybe things can get more components if you glue things together.
Yeah, I agree with this.
Okay. so, but I just want to make sure that if Carlo is around, Carlo agrees that there is a, that in EPRL model, what one gets for equation of motion is something like 32, and then we still have to understand how it agrees with Einstein's equations. Is that the...
Carlo is not here.
Okay, would anyone else like to make a comment on Abhay's comment or any other comments?
Just one brief comment. It seems to me that 32 is a discrete equivalent of the Lebesgue equation of motion. So that's correct. The difference with the continuum is the fact that we are here as in the any standard discretization of Lebesgue in a piecewise flat regular-like context. And indeed, in this context, it's difficult to reconstruct all the components of the Kovacs tensor. So we are seeing here the same difficulty. And it's not a matter of the simple model. It's just a classical statement about working in the piecewise flat context, I think.
Thank you, Daniele.
Any other comments or questions? Okay, then let us conclude the talk. Let us thank the speaker.